This month, The Spectator becomes the first magazine in history to print 10,000 issues, and we'd like to celebrate with you. Subscribe to The Spectator for 12 weeks for just £12. Plus, we'll send you a bottle of commemorative Spectator gin, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/celebrate.
Welcome to Coronomics, The Spectator's six-part series on stories from countries turned upside down by COVID-19. I'm Kate Andrews. This new podcast will feature our panel, based around the world, as each person selects a story that gives you an inside look as to what's happening outside their windows. Silvia Ciarilli Borelli is reporting from Rome and former Italian correspondent for Politico Europe. Jennifer Creary is reporting from Hong Kong and managing editor of the Hong Kong Free Press. And Nick Gillespie is reporting from New York City and editor-at-large for Reason magazine. Welcome all. Nick, your story this week comes from the New York Times, a lengthy examination of the Trump administration's handling of COVID-19 in the early weeks. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's called He Could Have Seen What Was Coming Behind Trump's Failure on the Virus. And it tracks using a lot of internal memos from health agencies in particular, but other people involved in the Trump administration and the federal government, starting really in January, and all of the missteps and missed opportunities that the administration had to kind of get ahead of the virus coming here. And what is interesting to me is that, first off, it's a very detailed interior look into the decision-making apparatus of the Trump administration, which, to be open, you know, like, I don't think that any other administration would have been much different. And this is not as much in this story, but in other stories, which the Times and other people have covered. The two main public health agencies, the CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Food and Drug Administration, had early indicators that problems were really coming and that they were going to be big. And they chose both to kind of push them off and then also to assert their own monopoly on testing and on kind of coordinating a response, which they ended up doing very slowly and, much more importantly, catastrophically. The CDC was pushing a test. They kept people from doing tests, and then the test they pushed turned out to be, you know, invalid. But the Times piece is really good in kind of mapping how slow-moving the administration's response was, which is telling. But then it's also feeding into this idea, which I think we're going to be seeing as this goes on longer and longer, looking back and saying, look, this was the moment that we could have stopped everything, or we could have, you know, really choked it off, et cetera. And there is going to be so much Monday morning quarterbacking about this. It's going to take a very long time to understand exactly what went wrong with the government response and how to, you know, learn from that for the next one. So that's what I think is really fascinating about this account.
And Nick, the piece documents in detail how the president downplayed the severity of the threat at the start before his fairly rapid U-turn. And you're speaking to us from New York City, which is the epicenter of America's outbreak so far. How do you think those early decisions affected what you are now seeing locally?
You know, this is where it becomes really difficult to say, but both Andrew Cuomo, the governor of New York, as well as Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York, were slow. You know, they're political enemies of Donald Trump for all personal as well as ideological reasons. But they were pretty much in lockstep with him of saying, you know, we don't want to overreact. We don't want to panic. And they were kind of slow moving. New York as a city was a couple weeks behind other parts of the country, including major cities, and saying, OK, you got to lock everything down. And, you know, again, one of the things that I think is important is, you know, we want to figure out what is the decision tree of all of this kind of stuff. But so much of it gets blended into settling political scores. Somebody like Bill de Blasio is widely seen as an incompetent mayor, even by his supporters. And so are you, when you're attacking him, are you attacking him because you want him out of office, or you want his office, or is it because he made fundamental mistakes that other people could have seen coming? It gets dicey pretty quickly. New York right now, you know, it's the largest city by more than two times in America. I live in Manhattan, and you wander around, and it's, you know, during the day and in the evening, it's like out of a movie of the apocalypse. I mean, there are very few people walking around. Things seem to be shut down. It seems like we might be going through a plateau of deaths, which is, you know, one of the early indicators that things will start reversing, but it's anybody's guess.
Jennifer, the U.S. has a reputation for being a world leader on so many fronts, but do you think the way that it's handled COVID-19 so far could change this?
Well, I think that people are looking to other countries as an example of how to handle the crisis. At least from what I'm reading, the US has been relatively slow in responding to the pandemic. But certainly in Asia, at least where we are, in Hong Kong, we've managed to slow the number of infections. And particularly in places like Taiwan, they've really managed to tackle the pandemic well by implementing travel restrictions pretty early on. And so when we contrast what's happening in the US to other Asian countries, it seems like the US is lagging.
Sylvia, Italy was one of the first Western countries to be very badly hit by COVID-19. So as you watched that all play out from your window, did you look at the States and even other Western countries and think that they were acting too slow?
Well, I think in retrospect, we can say that both the US and the UK might have acted too slow, at least initially. I think it's a very difficult situation because you've got to mitigate the economic impact of shutting everything down and the impact on health. So I think potentially the reason for which the US was slower than other countries, I'm thinking about Italy, but even a couple of others in Europe, is because, of course, they know that the economic impact of shutting everything down will be devastating. And this is election year, so obviously it will have a big impact on the president and on the government as well. I also think there was a lot of confusing information, not just in the US, but throughout Europe. Italy, for example, decided to shut down direct flights with China at the end of January, but that didn't really solve the problem. And it was the country that was hit most severely as early as February, because obviously there were people coming in through indirect flights. So I think policies have deferred a lot around the world, and it was just a very hard situation to confront. And it's, you know, it's easier now in retrospect to say that everyone should have acted differently, but there are so many different interests that have to be balanced here and that are at stake that it's complicated.
If I can kind of add to that, in the United States, I think one of the things, you know, that is coming into clearer focus is we have gone through, or we're in a phase now where the only thing that matters is a kind of public health dimension to this. You know, and Andrew Cuomo, governor of New York, has said, you know, he wants to make it so that nobody dies from coronavirus. And that isn't the only consideration. I mean, it sounds horrible to say, but when you shut down the economy, and we threw a kill switch on the economy in mid-March, that has effects which not only have economic effects, but also have health effects as well. I think we're a long way away from really being able to start to disentangle what is the best response, because you have to be able to factor in all of the effects. And we don't even know what the case fatality rate is, you know, in most places with any certitude. And then to figure out what are the kind of second and third term effects of this. You know, we're so far away from understanding that.
We'll look at the knock-on health effects slightly later in the podcast, and I'm sure in the weeks to come with our panel. But now I want to turn to Jennifer. Your story from Hong Kong also looks at the intersection between the virus and political crisis, but from a very different perspective. So can you tell us about it?
Right. So I think it's worth just giving a bit of context behind the story that I've chosen, because Hong Kong, like many other countries and territories, has implemented a raft of social distancing measures. But it's interesting to look at how these measures have almost instantly been politicized. As some of you may know, Hong Kong has just undergone months of civil unrest over a now withdrawn extradition bill, which would have enabled fugitive transfers to mainland China. Of course, the movement spiraled into a wider display of discontent against the government, police, Beijing's encroachment. Specifically, when it comes to the police, it's the force's handling of the crisis, so allegations of brutality and misconduct. And so these measures, which were introduced a few weeks ago, March 29th, so they include gatherings of no more than four people and a minimum distance of 1.5 meters between restaurant tables. And so it's worth bearing in mind that public trust in the police, the government and its affiliated institutions are at a record low. And so the concern is that these measures will effectively empower police to selectively police. So, for example, targeting protesters or protester-friendly businesses. So the story that I selected is about a district councillor who was at an event, a memorial, to mark a particular protest that happened last year. And he was walking away from it when the police stopped him and basically gathered him up with four other people who he did not know and gathered them together and then accused them of breaching the ban on gatherings of more than four people, because of course there were five of them. And so I just want to add a few more stories, just examples to kind of back this up. So there have been reports of police raiding protester-friendly cafes twice in 15 minutes to check that they were complying with the table distancing rule. There was also another report of police entering a pro-democracy tatanteng, so like a local restaurant, to basically allegedly just take the IDs of those inside and so on. And so the reason I chose the story was because I think it really speaks to the intersection between the political crisis last year in Hong Kong and COVID-19 and how really the public has very little trust in the government's handling of the current outbreak. And I think just more importantly, the most important point from this is that the public is currently not sure whether these laws will stay in place till after the virus is over. And so there's certainly very low levels of public trust in the police and the government and how it's going to handle this crisis.
Jennifer, you've been on the ground in Hong Kong reporting on these protests and uprising long before the virus came along. From your perspective, to what extent does this heavy-handed approach from the police or this targeted approach compare to what was happening during the height of the protests?
Right. So at the height of the protests last year, I mean, it was very much, at one point it was even daily street clashes, citywide street clashes. And so we saw police using tear gas, pepper spray, water cannons, that kind of stuff, and also protesters throwing Molotovs. So it was extremely violent and visceral. But now, because of the outbreak, I mean, before the outbreak, the protests were coming to a lull. And because of COVID-19, now protesters aren't really willing to go out, although they do occasionally do it, for example, to protest, you know, setting up of quarantine facilities in local neighborhoods, that kind of stuff. But this approach is, I'd say it's not as heavy as last year, but you can really feel the anger in the public against the police and these accusations of selective policing, which really, they really boil down to the fact that many people believe that the police have not been held accountable for their actions last year. There is currently supposedly an investigation ongoing. The results have not been released yet, but definitely there's still public anger, but the approach from the police has changed.
Sylvia, police intervention has been a topic in numerous countries as these lockdown measures have granted them more power. There was a video out from Italy that went viral of Italian mayors telling people to go home, to stop playing ping pong, and the rest. Now, some people thought they were enjoying that a bit too much. From your perspective, what has the response from Italy's law enforcement been like, and how does it compare to what you just heard?
Well, I think that has changed across the past month. In the beginning, many people across Italy, especially in southern region that hadn't been hit as badly as the northern ones, were underestimating the impact of coronavirus. And, you know, it's warm, it's spring. People wanted to be out in the sun. They were just going jogging or visiting parks with their children that were home from school. So that is where police intervention really made the difference and clamping down on people that weren't abiding by the rules and raising fines to 3,000 euro for those who were outside their home without a clear justification really helped. But then I also think the public really changed their approach, and as the death toll rose, people really understood this wasn't just a little more than a seasonal flu. And so people started getting to grips with what the new situation was going to be like and what they had to do. So for example, across Easter weekend, there were almost 800,000 police checks. 800,000 police checks across Easter weekend, and only 5% of those who were checked by police were sanctioned. So it means that most people are actually following the rules, and although it's warm and it's spring and it's hot, the people really aren't going outside that much and police aren't really having to intervene too much. But at the same time, there is the military that is supporting police in certain regions, especially down south, and there have been police zones around the red zones and the municipalities that are in lockdown and have been quarantined because they've suffered severe outbreaks.
Nick, there will always be those who overstep or abuse the power that they've given at any time, not just during a global pandemic. Of course, in America, issues around police brutality were there before COVID and have often been featured internationally. How is it panning out now?
You know, I think that discourse has shifted in a couple of ways. And one is that there have been some cases, and there was a highly publicized thing in Philadelphia, an incident in Philadelphia where police went onto a bus, a city bus, and pulled a guy off because he wasn't wearing a mask. And it was like 10 cops pulling this guy off. It was put on the Drudge Report, and the video of it went, you know, very viral. And the city of Philadelphia has changed its policy about harassing people without, who aren't wearing masks on public transit. But by and large, the conversation is less about police brutality because you haven't seen that kind of overstepping. And it's at a somewhat higher level. In states like Michigan and Vermont, the governors have issued, and Pennsylvania actually, have issued overly broad restrictions on what is essential and what is considered a non-essential good. So you'll have jurisdictions where you're not allowed to buy house paint, or you're not allowed to go into a Walmart. You can go into a Walmart to certain aisles, but then other things like the toy aisle is shut down or something like that. And people are starting to respond poorly to that or negatively and with hostility towards that. The other thing where you see the discussion is that, you know, this disease is hitting different people differently. And so clearly, you know, overwhelmingly, the people who are at most risk of hospitalization and of death are older people with underlying medical conditions. But it also seems to be taking a higher toll on Black and Latino populations, which generally have, you know, worse than average health for a variety of reasons that people are discussing. So we're talking, I think, more about that than about how this plays out in a police kind of law enforcement setting.
That's interesting. In the UK, they have not declared what you can and cannot buy in a shop that's legally allowed to be open. There was a little bit of pushback before Easter about very select groups of people trying to stop shops from selling chocolate eggs and the rest. And there was so much pushback that died a death.
In the United States, obviously, first off, this is hitting regionally in very different ways. And in some states, there's still about 6 or 8 states that don't have stay-at-home orders of any sort. And they're, you know, not necessarily suffering for a variety of reasons. So it's a very decentralized response in many ways, which is also fascinating because a lot of Trump's critics in general, you know, they've said he's acting like a madman. He's a dictator. He's an authoritarian. He's trying to be like Putin or Orban in Hungary. And then at the same time, they're saying, you know, he needs to use various laws to force manufacturers to produce things that are in short supply now. He needs to issue national orders and stuff like that. So the political discourse here, which is never particularly coherent, is undergoing a lot of different, you know, kind of attitudes where, you know, people who fear Trump are nonetheless calling for him to kind of flex more as a national leader. But the way the political structure is set up, it is somewhat decentralized. And you're seeing that. Different states are taking different approaches. And people are, you know, kind of responding to that in different ways.
And really quickly, Jennifer, the international spotlight has been on Hong Kong for the way it's been handling quarantine measures. If you are thought to have been close to somebody who's infected with the virus, you are picked up and taken to a state-sanctioned facility where you are monitored and you're not allowed to leave until it's thought that you're safe to do so. Now, a lot of people have actually been praising this, saying it's very efficient and it's a good way of tackling the spread of the virus. But you're saying that actually a lot of people in Hong Kong are skeptical of this and not very trusting of it. So can you give us the other side of that story?
Right. So I think that debate largely centers upon whether or not Hong Kong authorities are credited with slowing down the rate of infections. Because we look at other Asian countries, even Taiwan as well, again, implements quarantine measures. So this isn't exclusive to Hong Kong. As you said, the international image is that, perception is that Hong Kong is handling the crisis well, but at least locally, there's the idea that this is not so much because of Hong Kong authorities and these measures, but rather it's Hong Kong people themselves who have taken it upon themselves to take precautions, because this affected Hong Kong relatively early on because, of course, we are very close to China. But we must remember that Hong Kong has a collective trauma over SARS, which happened in 2003, and Hong Kong was hit pretty hard by it. Nearly 300 people died. And as a result, when the outbreak was first starting, you really saw how that translated into how people interacted with each other in the street. For example, buying face masks, practicing social distancing, and to such a point whereby, you saw panic buying and surgical masks were really dwindling in supplies. They're okay now. But at least locally, the argument is that it's not so much Hong Kong, but rather the people themselves who are deciding to practice these measures and so on.
Fascinating. Sylvia, let's move to Italy. So here in the UK, we thought that the EU would dominate the conversations this year as a post-Brexit trade deal was supposed to be negotiated between Britain and the EU. However, it's gone very quiet in the wake of coronavirus. That's not true in Italy, however, where the EU is still front and center of the COVID crisis. Can you tell us more about your story?
I chose a story in Bloomberg that is called Italy Will Struggle to Sell the EU Rescue Deal at Home. I think it sums up quite well what the debate is currently focused on here in Italy. We seem to be past the peak, although the numbers are still high. And the question now is, how are we going to restart our lives? And how does the government plan to navigate the economic impact of the coronavirus outbreak? And as it often happens, when it rains, it pours. And as we know, Italy is one of the world's most indebted countries, with an economy that has barely grown in recent years. So obviously, a two-month total shutdown isn't going to help. Experts are now forecasting a drop in more than 10% in GDP for this year. And the question is, how's the government planning to address this fallout? The problem is that the Prime Minister, Giuseppe Conte, raised expectations throughout the country that he could win support at a European level for some form of debt mutualization, whether we want to call them Eurobonds or Corona bonds. But Eurozone finance ministers last week came back with an agreement that is a far cry from what Italy is asking for and what it is still hoping for. So essentially, what the Eurozone finance ministers agreed is that the Eurozone Rescue Fund, the European Stability Mechanism, will allow members to borrow 2% of their GDP to fund healthcare expenses. And these loans won't have any kinds of strings attached as they normally would have. But of course, Italy is very skeptical about using the ESM, the European Stability Mechanism, because they fear it would somehow limit national sovereignty and impose austerity measures or structural reforms, which has been the case during the euro crisis 10 years ago for Greece, for example. Now, the Italian finance minister has said that Italy got its way and this tool will be able to be used without any forms of strings attached or conditionality. But if you read what the Dutch finance minister or even the Finnish finance ministers have said after this meeting, they were actually saying quite the opposite, saying that, of course, countries will be supported to help reconstruct their healthcare system, but the tools that are made available at a European level do indeed have strings attached, and that every country has to be responsible for its own economy, and there will be no common debt issuance. Now, all of this story is very toxic in Italy, which essentially has two very strong populist parties. One is in opposition, Matteo Salvini's far-right League party, and the other one is in government, the Five Stars Movement. So essentially, all the confusion around this and the fact that the Prime Minister had essentially said in the beginning that the EU's bailout fund was the right tool to fight this crisis, but then he changed his mind and said that it was an inadequate tool, essentially backing what the populist Five Stars Movement has been saying all along, and has made the situation very difficult because, of course, if he won't be able to deliver what he promised, and if his expectations will be somehow defeated by what the Eurozone finance ministers decide when they next meet on April 23rd, the political situation here is going to further weaken. This is a coalition government we're talking about in Italy, and it was weak before this crisis happened. And now, essentially, it's going to face a political crisis while it navigates a pandemic and an economic crisis. So the problem, essentially, will be understanding how the Eurozone and the stronger European countries' demands will work for fragile countries, which also includes Portugal and Spain, and how they're going to navigate their enormous debt pile once the crisis is behind our backs, but the debt pile will be even larger.
And there's been a lot of criticism that the European Central Bank didn't act fast enough, especially to help smaller Eurozone members whose economies are extremely vulnerable at the moment. There have been reports of EU countries turning inward, not sharing supplies and medical resources, allowing the nation-state approach to trump the union. Do you get a sense from your conversations in Rome that these tensions will disappear when the virus is under control, or does this spell trouble for the harmony of the union as a whole?
I think it will spell trouble for the harmony of the union. And what I've noticed and what I've been struck by is the fact that even pro-EU politicians and European Union supporters here have been very critical of the behavior of other countries, with Germany at the forefront throughout this entire crisis, both because, as you said, some countries have closed their borders, they haven't helped with personal protective equipment, and the response, the economic response for more fragile countries like Italy wasn't considered sufficient, at least not here. And the fact that the Italian public was sold this idea that only common debt issuance would do it in a situation as dramatic as this one has really raised expectations, and it's very likely that the government, the Italian government, won't be able to live up to these expectations. So to get out of this hole they've dug themselves, they will have to blame the EU somehow. So it means that there is a very big chance that going forward, the perception and Euroscepticism across Italy will go into the mainstream, and it won't be something that belongs to the populace anymore. A bit like what happened with Brexit in the UK. In the beginning, it started out as something that was quite fringe, but when it made it into the mainstream, then we know what happened. So it might not go as far as Brexit in Italy, because Italy is part of the Eurozone and it shares a currency with other European countries. But at the same time, I think it will be very, very complicated going forward to backtrack from the situation if Euroscepticism rises forward and the response isn't united enough, as it doesn't look like it will be right now.
Nick, you touched on this a little bit before, but what is the relationship between the federal government's actions in the states and state action right now? Obviously, it's not a direct comparison with the EU, but are tensions brewing at different levels of government in the U.S.?
Yeah, they are. And there is, you know, the federal government just a couple of weeks ago passed a $2.2 trillion spending bill to kind of keep the economy afloat for a couple of weeks. They're already talking about by the end of the month having another bill that could be another $2 trillion or $1 trillion more, which is effectively what happened a month ago, or less than a month ago, is that the federal government increased its budget by 50%. A lot of that money is supposed to go directly to individuals and to businesses. That's already starting to fall apart, but a big chunk of it is also going to the states to float certain types of things. There are serious questions about state pension funds. And, you know, it varies widely. I mean, the United States, in a way, is like the EU in that you have very wealthy states and you have very poor states. You have states that maintain their finances well and have big rainy day funds for situations like this, and others that have virtually nothing. So that is all going to be, you know, coming to a head over the next couple of weeks. And then it also varies by need. New York State and New York City, I believe, have more coronavirus cases, not just than the rest of the U.S. put together, but I think than any individual country at this point, you know, active cases. And so, you know, this is a major flashpoint. And Donald Trump, I think most people would say to his discredit, is not shy about talking about, you know, that as he gives things out. One of the things that's kind of fascinating, go back to the New York situation, because Trump is from New York originally, he has a very complicated and gnarly relationship with Andrew Cuomo and with Bill de Blasio. And that, you know, that may affect the way things get done. So we'll see.
Jennifer, what are the discussions happening in Hong Kong right now about recovery measures? How is it going to look economically there when you come out on the other side?
Right. So even before the coronavirus, Hong Kong's economy was pretty battered from the protests last year. They went on for months. And recently, the financial secretary projected a fiscal deficit for the next 5 years, for financial year 2020-2021, as high as 280 billion Hong Kong dollars if you factor in lost tax and land sale revenue. So the economy is already doing pretty poorly. But, you know, Hong Kong has very large fiscal reserves, $1.1 trillion Hong Kong dollars. But recently, in terms of helping out individuals and businesses that are struggling, the chief executive Carrie Lam, that's Hong Kong's top post, announced a coronavirus relief package of $137 billion. So this is to support individuals, industries that are particularly hard hit by the virus. But there's criticism over that as well. The criticism is that the money will be given to individuals and businesses who will essentially keep the money for themselves and just continue to fire employees, and there's no real protection for the employee themselves. As I mentioned previously, there's a lot of distrust in how the government is going to handle this in terms of protecting individuals, businesses, and so on.
Fascinating. Thanks, Jennifer. So on to our last story. The big news out from the UK this weekend was that Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was admitted into intensive care as he battled coronavirus, has left hospital and is on his way to recovery. He released a video thanking staff in the National Health Service for their help and treatment. One of the biggest concerns in the UK was that there wasn't going to be enough capacity within the NHS to treat COVID patients. But that's definitely been built in now. This, however, has had a serious knock-on effect. A story from the Financial Times has recently revealed that close to half of the beds in some of these English hospitals are empty now. So before the virus, about 800 of the NHS's 4,100 critical care beds were vacant at any given time. Now it's over 2,000 beds that are vacant, and that number is rising. And this is raising questions about the indirect effects of the lockdown, not just economic ones like we've been speaking about, but also health-related ones. People are clearly not seeking the treatment that they need sometimes, potentially in very serious circumstances. So to that end, I was hoping each of you could just give a small update as to what access to healthcare has been like in your cities, and if there are any interesting or worrying patterns to note.
Yes, so the tendency in Italy has been to separate the facilities that treat COVID patients from those that don't treat COVID patients. But unfortunately, many of the non-COVID facilities have turned into epicenters of COVID outbreaks because people have gone infected inside hospitals. So the problem here now is that many people are being asked to stay at home and they don't find places in hospital to treat other diseases or other health problems that aren't related to COVID. And especially in Lombardy, where hospitals are running at maximum capacity or over maximum capacity, we are hearing reports of people actually dying at home from an array of different diseases because they can't make it to the hospital, or emergency and health services don't actually even respond to their calls.
Right, so it's a little bit different in Hong Kong in that a lot of the testing measures are done, particularly with people who have just arrived in Hong Kong near the airport. So recently, the government has announced, introduced a measure whereby arrivals from particularly hard-hit countries, including the US and the UK, many of whom are Hong Kong residents and are, for example, study abroad students who are returning to Hong Kong, those people will be tested at a facility near the airport. And so to that end, they cannot leave the facility until they receive a negative result. But beyond that, there was already a 14-day quarantine measure in place for all arrivals anyway. And so the government introduced these electronic wristbands that would basically track whether or not a person will have left their facility, their quarantine area. And so the government has been introducing these kind of measures to basically stay in touch with people who may or may not be confirmed to have the virus.
In New York in particular, and this is true of the country more broadly, but a couple of days ago, the official model that was being used to kind of, you know, plan for things said that New York was going to need 140,000 hospital beds. It turned out only about 18,000 were being used. And, you know, it's kind of what you're talking about, Kate, in the UK. As a result, there are many reports of hospitals that are basically underutilized and people who had either elective surgery, which doesn't mean, you know, it's not serious surgery. It's just it can be scheduled a little bit down the road. Are going waiting, as well as there are lots of reports of ambulances being called for, heart attacks or things like that, and nobody coming because everything is focused on coronavirus. And there has been, at least to date, a major, major overestimation of the resources needed in hospitals among first responders and things like that. This is one of the things we'll find out the extent to which other harms were caused in the, in the service of prioritizing coronavirus cases.
Yeah, no doubt these trade-offs will be discussed sooner rather than later as well as we deal with the lockdown measures. Jennifer, Sylvia, Nick, thanks so much for joining me. Looking forward to your updates next week. To hear from the panel on next week's Coronomics episode, subscribe to our podcast channel, Spectator Radio. And if you're listening in America, you can subscribe to The Spectator at spectator.us/subscribe. Use the promo code KATE for a discount.